Hello everyone. I'm making this video because I heard a interview by Fido Bogan in as he was being interviewed by A Voice for Men. Now, I have nothing against Fido Bogan, and this is not that kind of a video. I'm not attacking him or anything like that. I happen to think that he's made some very good videos, anti-feminism videos in the past. This is not an attack video, so to speak, but in the interview he said something that was just so that I felt so strongly about that I feel I have to respond. Now, in this interview, he was being interviewed about at one point in the interview they were talking about the topic of hypergamy and how certain abrasive MRAs or whatever you want to call them talk too much about hypergamy. That we have an obsession with it apparently, and that if that and this particular part that I'm about to add in was suggested pretty much in no uncertain terms by Fido Bogan that we should stop talking about hypergamy as non-feminist or anti-feminist or MRAs or whatever you want to call it. Because it serves no purpose, and that we alienate women by talking too much about hypergamy, and that we shouldn't talk about it. And at the most, if we do talk about it, we should limit it. We should just touch on it and just keep it moving. Now, I highly disagree with this statement, and my video, or this video, is going to address that. Now, I think that. I'm just going to go ahead and say, and the interview is in the description box, by the way. I don't remember exactly when he said this, but the interview is rather short. If you've ever heard to A Voice for Men, if you've ever heard A Voice for Men news, which I thoroughly enjoy and have been on by myself. This is an attack on Fido Bogan or A Voice for Men either. What they usually do when they're interviewing someone is they'll go through a portion of just I guess reading back misandry news or news having to do with misandry and men's rights and then they'll bring on the interviewer and Fido Bogan honestly wasn't on for a very long time. Must have been only like maybe 20 minutes at the most. So I'll put the link in the description box and feel free to listen to the interview just because I want everybody to know exactly what was said. Now, I'm just going to go ahead and say that no amount of female MRAs, I think, and this is just my opinion here, no amount of female MRAs that we could potentially attract are worth having to stop talking about hypergamy. This female instinct for the bigger, better deal is well documented, and men that are ignorant of it or that make a conscious decision to ignore it will learn about it the hard way, usually through the wrong end of a family divorce court settlement. Now, I simply cannot understand why Fido Bogan or anybody would insist that men going their own way should self-censor themselves when dealing with the topic of hypergamy. Because I feel that is such an integral concept to understand as a man seeking to navigate this climate of misandry we exist in today. But I'm honestly starting to see some subtle and not so subtle ways, the not so subtle being the blatant suggestion that hypergamy should be discussed at minimum length, if at all, because it may alienate women, and the subtle ways it being this idea that hypergamy is somehow this completely learned behavior. As the women in America groomed by 60 years of feminism are the only ones who have exhibited hypergamy. But yeah, I'm starting to see some subtle and not so subtle ways in which we're being kind of encouraged to kind of stay quiet on the hypergamy issue. And I'm just going to say right here and right now that under no circumstances am I going to stop talking about hypergamy on this channel. Specifically in regards to the issue of whether or not women outside of the West and in America who haven't been groomed by 60 years of feminism have ever exhibited hypergamy. Watch my video Traditionalism, Nothing But Business and a Bottom Line, where I give numerous examples of highly patriarchal civilizations like India and China, which are thousands of years old, that had feminism entrench itself in a single generation. That means 20 years or less. And the women are divorcing in the exact same ratio and quantities as their American and Western counterparts. Exact ratios. Now, I explained that away as learned behavior when it all unfolded in one third the time that American feminism did. Now, you know, I can personally attest that over the years I've had this channel, I've personally received what has had to be a few thousand emails telling me that this channel and others that put an emphasis on female nature and even male nature, particularly in regards to what causes them to behave the way they do, females, in regards to men, have completely changed their outlook on life for the better, and how it was the missing piece that they needed to finally break out of the blue pill provider protector role. And so now people are suggesting that we should simply stop educating men on hypergamy in hopes that some women won't be alienated? Under no circumstances is that going to happen. Now, I'm just going to personally state that any MRA or other prominent member of the manosphere that believes that we should stop educating men about hypergamy, and when I say educating, I mean talking to men at length about it, with no regard towards how women will take it. Anyone that thinks that we should stop doing this, it would probably be better if we all just simply agree that we, as this variant of men going their own way, and you as that particular variant of MRA or non-feminist or whatever moniker you identify by, should simply admit that we are completely different in the goals we're trying to achieve. Now, if it's easier for you to simply tell people that you don't associate or claim any resemblance to those that consider hypergamy something that is an elemental concept that all men should understand in depth, that we essentially can't talk enough about, we're not going to get mad. I mean, the time for bickering is over, and people understand now that there are overlap but very real differences between the way men going their own way approach things and MRAs approach things, but we under no circumstances are going to stop talking about this. I mean, the ignorance of things like hypergamy and male disposability are what causes suicides after divorce. I mean, I can't even begin to express just how important it is to talk about these things, and I wouldn't stop even if every woman on planet Earth joined the men's movement tomorrow. I mean, this isn't an insult to women to say this, it's just a simple fact. Female nature must be understood and spelled out to men very clearly. The choices they make after that is up to them, but under no circumstances are we going to silence our description of it for a perpetual men's rights campaign. And really, you know, that's what it is, isn't it? You know, this constantly having to check our tone and rhetoric and say things in just the right way because, you know, well, we don't want to sound like we hate women. And, you know, I guess that's fine, but it's never enough, is it? You know, because of course, the SPLC put Fido Bogan's own blog on its list of anti-women hate groups. Fido Bogan's blog, someone who takes great care not to sound anti-women, so to speak. And ironically, he still gets branded as an anti-woman hate blog because, you see, a policy of appeasement with these people only increases the amount of contempt they have for you. That's what I think Fido Bogan doesn't understand. You know, and the women that were supposedly alienating would find supposedly anti-woman rhetoric in the most lukewarm of men's rights blog posts, because here's a crazy concept. You know, a good number of women are actually looking to find it even if it doesn't exist. Men going their own way are simply tired of walking on eggshells. You know, we crack them now. We crack them whenever they're in our path. I mean, we're just done. Absolutely done walking on eggshells. And our general mission, at least in this variant of men going their own way, is to get as many men to reject being a provider to women, a tax source for the state, and to start spending their time and hard-earned money for their benefit and enjoyment. Through this, we starve the system. It's just that simple. We want to starve the system because we believe the system, on some level, is irretrievably broken. And I know that might sound apathetic to you, but keep in mind that during the collapse of Rome, there were some people that didn't want to hear that Rome is collapsing. But Rome crossed a point. I mean, civilizations have their Rubicon points where as soon as you cross a certain point, as soon as you're sufficiently overextended militarily, as soon as you're, you know, and you know, interestingly enough, Rome had its own little feminism movement that cropped up on its own. I mean, you could see some pretty famous quotes from Roman generals talking about, you know, I'm paraphrasing right now, but something about how us Romans, we rule the world and our women rule over us. I mean, there was a little feminist movement that propped up in the days of Rome as well. But once you've become overextended militarily, financially, Once your women have the chains of hypergamy or the checks on hypergamy removed, your civilization is done for. Stick a fork in it. It's not coming back. And we believe that we have crossed this point. We could be wrong. You could be right. It might still be salvageable, but none of us know that answer for a fact. So that's our mission, just to get as many men out of the system, as many men out of the machine, as many men out of the meat grinder. Less blood for the machine. That's what we're about, as men going their own way. This variant of men going their own way. But I want to talk more about this men's rights perpetual PR campaign. This perpetual PR campaign approach that tasks us with having to sway the hearts and minds of enough people to pose a threat to the prominent gender narrative today. That being that women are victims and men are oppressors. We hear a lot today about how the men's movement is gaining steam and how we're pushing into the mainstream. But I'm going to be purposefully skeptical here because I don't want to give out that type of encouragement unless it's actually grounded in reality. Now, I wish I could tell you how far along we are in gaining acceptance from society at large. And injecting and solidifying our ideas into it, but we do have the emerging field of network science to help us gauge certain milestones that need to be reached for ideas to make the transition from those of the minority to those of the majority. We can now measure and visualize complex social networks. The entire search habits of the internet have been cataloged and measured. You're looking at a readout, an infographic of internet search activity, where, of course, the biggest circle depicted is going to be Google, and then things like Yahoo are going to follow after this. We have ways of mapping this now, and we have ways of creating these web network depictions or graphics, of entire Facebook networks, of the entire Facebook total network, even. And that's easily over 1 billion people. So why not apply this to social dynamics? We know that scientists have in fact discovered what you can call a tipping point for minority to majority idea propagation. So I'm just going to read you really quickly this brief little article here about a study done at the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Now it's a little bit lengthy, so just bear with me here. I'm just going to review some brief excerpts of this article, which is also in the description box, by the way. Scientists at the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute have found that when just 10% of the population holds an unshakable belief, their belief will always be adopted by the majority of the society. These scientists, who are members of the Social Cognitive Networks Academic Research Center at Rensselaer, used computational and analytical methods to discover the tipping point where a minority belief becomes the majority opinion. Now, they were quoted as saying as follows: "When the number of committed opinion holders is below 10%, there is no visible progress in the spread of ideas. It would literally take the amount of time comparable to the age of the universe for this size group to reach the majority. But once that number grows above 10%, the idea seems to spread like flame." And the methodology used is as follows. It says, to reach their conclusion, the scientists developed computer models of various types of social networks. One of the networks had each person connect to every other person in the network. The second model included certain individuals who were connected to a large number of people, making them opinion hubs or leaders. And the final model gave every person in the model roughly the same number of connections. The initial state of each of the models was a sea of traditional view holders. We'll call that our feminism in this case. Each of these individuals held a view, but were also importantly open-minded to other views. Sounds fair to me. It goes on to say, once the networks were built, the scientists then sprinkled in some true believers throughout each of the networks. These people were completely set in their views and unflappable in modifying those beliefs. As those true believers began to converse with those who held the traditional belief system, the tides gradually and then very abruptly began to shift. They're quoted as saying, "In general, people do not like to have an unpopular opinion and are always seeking to try locally to come to consensus. We set up this dynamic in each of our models. To accomplish this, each of the individuals in the models talked to each other about their opinion. If the listener held the same opinions as the speaker, it reinforced the listener's belief. If the opinion was different, the listener considered it and moved on to talk to another person. If that person also held this new belief, the listener then adopted that belief. Then it says that as agents of change start to convince more and more people, the situation itself begins to change. People begin to question their own views at first and then completely adopt the new view to spread it even further. If the true believers just influence their neighbors, that wouldn't change anything within the larger system, as we saw with percentages less than 10%. The article goes on to say that as soon as that 10% milestone was reached, the statistics showed that the idea would almost universally be accepted would become the traditional belief eventually, no matter what the case or context. So the reason I cite a study like this is because the perpetual PR campaign approach to men's rights requires us to sway enough minds to reach a certain tipping point. It requires us to patiently and slowly win over the blue pill world where feminism knows it has a majority consensus. We have to constantly be watching what we say and how we say it, and we have to do it long enough for enough minds to adopt our ideas. Let's say that this 10% figure is accurate, for example. You know, I'm not saying it is as fact, but let's just make that assumption. This means that in America, a population of 300 million, we would have to have sway 30 million minds to have any real effect. 30 million. Again, I'm not saying that this number is set in stone or concrete, but what I attempt to do on this channel is to quantify investment and return. Is the juice worth the squeeze? Is being on our best behavior, watching what we say constantly so as to not alienate women or any other group that is potentially sympathetic to our cause, going to actually bear any fruit in a reasonable amount of time? I mean, feminism took 3 or 4 decades to solidify itself as the dominant gender narrative in the West. And it had the advantage of a female collective instinct bolstering it. Now, why are we assuming that reversing or replacing this gender narrative with one that is equitable for both sexes through a perpetual PR campaign won't take at least as long? I mean, if it's even possible at this point, the men's rights movement, for various reasons, including male biology and political hypergamy, may very possibly be unable to replicate the political traction that women were able to gain via feminism. It might take us double the time. Again, if it's even possible. So let's talk again then about alienating women. The perpetual PR campaign approach puts an almost obsessive emphasis on not offending women, as evidenced by the suggestion that we should only talk about hypergamy as briefly as possible or even not at all. Now, me and others have posted various videos in which we talk at length about male nature. I've discussed the male mothering need, his need to believe in his own private Madonna, compelling men like Michael Jordan and Tiger Woods to marry. I've talked about man's chivalrous nature and his propensity for minimizing his own utilization by women. Notice though, and this is interesting, that nobody's suggesting that we stop talking about that, however. I mean, notice that we can lambast men for being manginas and white knights and somehow nobody cares. I mean, nobody talks about how that's unnecessary and counterproductive because it'll alienate men. Because you see, we actually hold men up to a standard of behavior. If they behave like simpering white knights, we point and say, look at the pathetic simpering white knights. And we could honestly care less about who gets offended by it. I mean, we don't worry about looking like a misandrist when we ridicule white knights. Yet we very much do worry about looking like a misogynist when we point out hypergamy. So it's not about alienating people here. It's about not alienating women. It's about this hypersensitivity towards women that got us in the situation that we're in the first place. Feminism came partly out of this hypersensitivity towards women that we have within even the men's rights movement. You know, by the same logic, if I point out that human nature shows us that we are a violent animal, a warlike species, does that make me a misanthrope now? I mean, if I'm an advocate for basic human rights, should I pretend that we aren't a warlike species because it might alienate people? No, it's the truth, and I'm not going to cover it up to spare people's feelings. The proponent of the perpetual men's rights PR campaign suggests we self-censor because quite simply he's a salesman, and he knows that customers that have an incentive to buy his product with very little persuasion from him, while those with no incentive to buy his product need to be sold. They need to be coaxed to buy his product. The question it all boils down to is incentives. Men have an incentive to join this movement because feminism and male disposability overwhelmingly target and harm men. Women don't because feminism and male disposability overwhelmingly benefit women. To say this might be abrasive or offensive to women, it might turn off some potential women looking to join the MRM, but it happens to be the truth. a truth that should not be covered up or ignored, but embraced and emphasized. We need to emphasize the quality of individual female MRAs instead of the acquisition of large numbers of flaky, on-the-fence female MRAs who want to abandon ship every time they're inconvenienced with a men going their own way discussion on hypergamy meant to educate and protect men. I mean, if that's all it takes for these particular female MRAs to jump ship while we're basically walking on eggshells to court them, well then just let them go. We're better off without them. I say it's a good thing that they left. Let them go back to being a moderate feminist or some other such bullshit, where they certainly didn't have much of a problem tolerating decades of prominent feminists calling for male genocide. Something that not even one prominent men going their own way, or MRA, or non-feminist, or whatever, has ever called for, ever. You see, what the men's movement is, in my opinion, much more likely to attract is the altruistic female. The few women that are in men's rights simply because they understand that men are being deprived their wealth and freedoms by the state, along with the complicity of an unignorable portion of the female population. This woman that I'm talking about understands a few key concepts. One being that assessing female demographics on a macroscopic scale says nothing about her as an individual. And two being that we are sick and tired of explaining to these exceptional female individuals that we aren't talking about them. We need women in this movement that are mature enough to understand that we are assessing female behavior in a way which can be optimized to benefit men. This optimum assessment just so happens to take place in the general sense. If you as a woman aren't mature enough to understand these things, that's your problem, and the men's movement isn't going to perpetually soothe female hurt feelings when we could be devoting our time to much more productive endeavors. Now, my honest opinion on the matter is that the men's rights movement will never be able to incentivize women to join this cause in any capacity significant enough for it to gain any major benefit simply from the presence of women in our movement alone. In my opinion, the sheer number of women it would take for the general public to say to itself, look, it's obvious that the men's rights movement doesn't hate women because look at how many women have joined their ranks. It's just the number that we would need is just too high. It would have to be tens or even hundreds of thousands of women. Our numbers in men aren't even close to approaching that number. Now, don't confuse this with me saying that we shouldn't accept women into this movement. We absolutely should. My question, though, is how will this incentive to bring them here be brought about? I mean, if you haven't noticed, women aren't exactly lining up asking where they can join. The current hypothesis I've seen floating around the manosphere is that one of our largest female constituencies will emerge out of women that see their husbands and sons taken to the cleaners in divorce and child support courts. But take into account that nestled in this statement is the undeniable fact that the incentive itself is by its definition created by more women than we could possibly attract with the incentive generated. That is to say that across all demographics of women that are marrying the sons and ex-husbands of these mothers and second marriage wives, they must be getting away with divorce and whatever other forms of male-to-female wealth transfer available so much and in such an odious fashion that mothers and second or third wives begin to take notice and take action. Since, taken as a whole, women give birth collectively to sons and daughters in the same proportion, we can assume that women with only daughters will never be exposed to this incentive. Since second and third marriages comprise a relatively small amount of total marriages, the potential pool of women that we can incentivize with this divorce inertia is of course women with sons and women with husbands or boyfriends that have already suffered through a divorce. But the pool of women creating the incentive opportunity through this divorce inertia can be women without sons, or women on their first marriages, or really any demographic of women. The presence of divorce and male-to-female wealth transfer must be very high for only a limited amount of women from select demographics having male overlap to take notice. And another thing to consider is the fact that as the men's movement fights to end male-to-female wealth transfer and divorce, the incentive for those women will disappear, making success in divorce reform a limiting factor for this female MRA constituency. Now, this state of affairs isn't all bad, however, because what we've just discussed allows us to highlight what I mean when I say, is the juice worth the squeeze? Now, even though I'm skeptical about the amounts of women that we can sway by pointing and saying, you know, look what feminist divorce laws have done to your sons and husbands, we also don't have to work to attract these women. The feminist divorce laws will do all that for us. These women, however small or large in number they are much more likely to be committed to our movement and to not tuck tail and run when women are appropriately generalized for the purposes of explaining hypergamy or other subjects that benefit men. They've seen the damage that divorce can do to their sons and husbands, and I'd imagine they'd have to fight down an urge to bitch slap any person, male or female, that tells them, you know, don't worry about that. Don't worry about the fact that your son or husband is getting the crap divorced out of them because, well, you know, not all women are like that. They know not all women are like that, and yet enough of them are that now it's landed right on her doorstep. I mean, she's just not trying to hear it. The same way we're not trying to hear it. I mean, she's seen enough of what we have seen as MRAs and men going their own way to know it's time to do some serious generalizing, and the exceptions will just have to walk it the fuck off and get over it. Yes, you've been generalized. You've been generalized out of necessity. Get over it. The point is that I have no problem with women in the men's movement at all, but I will not go out of my way to make them comfortable because I don't go out of my way to make men comfortable. I mean, if you like what's being said on this channel, you can subscribe. You don't? Well, go elsewhere. Part of the reason I stick to this channel, and I don't claim any official affiliation with any other group in the manosphere, is because I never want to be put in a situation where I can't say whatever I please for fear of compromising an attempt at giving the men's rights movement or anything else in the manosphere a facelift. And it's appropriate, I think, to be clear and to say that I have no affiliation with any men's rights organization that believes we should not speak about hypergamy, or male disposability, or Brifel's law, or any other aspect of female nature, period. And quite frankly, I'm not even an MRA. I can't even hold that title anymore. And I'm not a non-feminist. You know, I don't believe feminism was this magical evil that descended from the mountains in the form of a cloud to infect Western civilization. I believe it simply to be an, at best, minimally socially engineered, natural and organic eventuality that resulted from and is perpetuated by the peculiar natures of both the human male and female. My suggestion to the men's rights movement going forward is that they focus not on a wasteful approach that revolves around showing the blue pill masses that we're not extremists or women haters. No matter how we say it, the blue pill masses will seek to characterize us as just that. I mean, we saw this when Jessica Valenti, despite the fact that no prominent MRAs have ever called for violence against women, we saw this when she tried to tie us in with the likes of George Soldini. The only reason that didn't stick is because he very clearly only had a minimal involvement with the PUA world, but believe me, they will find some way to label us extremists no matter what we say. My suggestion is to focus on targeted legal battles that can be changed. Not on convincing all of womankind that we don't hate them. You know, affirmative action for women, as an example. Pure discrimination against men and in violation of multiple constitutional amendments. Class action lawsuit waiting to happen. Let the women that want to join us do so. But let's devote our energy and time and money to suing these motherfuckers. I mean, it's time to start attacking these people. I want to fight. You know, I don't want to fucking dance around in a way that women feel safe and sound so that maybe, just maybe, sometime before a manned mission to Mars, we can start discussing the privileges that women have been unfairly extended at the expense of men. I want to fight these people now. Whether or not women feel comfortable with it, I want to fight them now. You know, class action lawsuits may be expensive, but relatively speaking, compared to the time and energy expended in showing the entire world that we don't hate women every second of every day, it's much cheaper. And we're fighting the actual legal issue at hand. Selective service, class action lawsuit waiting to happen. You know, I donate my time and money to that. Something that actually directly addresses the problem. And we don't need to recruit women for that. They can help us if they want. But if they choose not to, we don't need them to do this. You know, and you gotta ask yourself, you know, is it important to you the reasons why these women are helping us? Is it important to you that they're helping us for either of two reasons? A, they're altruistic and they want to help us and they really see a human rights violation. Or B, you know, their son is getting divorced and now it's affecting them. I mean, these kind of things, they may not be important in the long term, but they certainly, you know, it certainly matters to some people. That's something that we should all think about. You know, what are your reasons for being here as a woman? Again, we all do things to validate our own incentives, so I'm not here to tell women why they should or shouldn't be in the men's rights movement, but I'm just saying that in the meantime, we certainly are not going to stop talking about hypergamy or female nature or any of these things. And if they offend you, then maybe you should find somewhere else where people are voluntarily self-censoring themselves so that you can be comfortable and not hear things that you don't want to hear. But that's not what you're going to find here. That's all I really got to say for now. Thanks for listening.